Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schrankelber, and John Paskowitz is on the line again. Hey, John.
Hi, Fred.
All right. So I'm still working on my morning coffee here. So I'm still in that, you know, sitting at the coffee shop kind of feel. And so you're probably into your day and making things happen. But have you made your flight arrangements to Rams yet?
Yes, I have. Yeah. Unfortunately, from St. Louis here, we have some direct flights on Southwest to Orlando. And so it's not too bad. I got a good price on Southwest, and they're pretty good. So, yeah, I have my flight arrangements, and I arranged at an alternate hotel. One of the things I don't particularly like about Rams is they always have them at these expensive resorts.
Lately they have been. Yeah, it's the last three. They went to Vegas and stayed off strip at a place that was, oh, what a pit. But it was cheap.
Yeah. But, it's always a trade-off getting, you know, companies got to pay for the travel and so on. And, you know, making it more reasonable is good. And yet they want to have a facility that can accommodate the large number of people and simultaneous tracks they do. I'm sure it's not easy.
That's true. It's been a battle. But one of the things they do have there is, Rams was there a number of years ago at the same facility at the Rosen Plaza. Mm-hmm. And there's a long hallway between the hotel lobby and where the conference rooms are. Mm-hmm. And it's got restaurants and bars and coffee shops and all kinds of good stuff. Plus lots and lots of seating areas just to get together and chat. So that's the part I'm really looking forward to, is getting a chance to catch up with folks and some friends I've, you know, known only through Rams and get to see them once a year.
Yeah.
New people that get introduced and we sit down and chat. What I'm really looking for is listeners to the show, to the different podcasts, to put a face to the listeners, really, and really ask the question. And so what do you like? What don't you like? What would you like to talk about? And then hook a microphone up and say, well, join us, you know, let's get on the air and do a show.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I like you point out, the facility like that is unusual. A lot of hotels don't have that, a venue where you can break off and do small discussions like that. And so that would be advantageous to doing some sessions with some of the attendees.
Mm-hmm. Well, last year I was in the hotel bar, which was really quiet because we were the only venue there. So there wasn't mm-hmm. much else going on. So that worked out great. I'll have to scout around a little bit at this hotel, find a spot where we can squirrel away and get reasonably quiet.
Quiet. Mm-hmm.
But we'll make it pretty obvious where we're at if we can, and more than happy to talk to listeners and get you on a future show. But really, if you're not interested in getting on the show with us, we certainly want to meet you and get to know what you would like us to talk about, what would be most helpful for you. That would be absolutely great. So let us know. Go to reliability.fm, and you can find comments and suggestion box type forms there that you can get in touch with us. Or just send us an email. We're pretty obviously easy to get a hold of. Under the About pages, you'll find all of us and our contact info. So that'd be great. So one of the questions that came up recently, John, and this was from a listener, was, you know, we're designing a new product, we're in startup mode, and we don't have a previous product out. How do I get a good handle on what is our customer need, right? Mm-hmm. In some cases, and I know you've had more of had some military type background, you know, they just send it to you. Here's the 89 page document with all of the requirements, make it so. But sometimes we don't have anything. In other cases, it's somewhere in between. We say, well, we think they're going to use it outdoors. We're not sure.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest problems in defining reliability requirements is bridging the gap between what's on a specification document, which is like the military way. They got a statement of, they request a statement of work and a proposal, and that's here's some of the requirements we need from an operational standpoint. And mm-hmm. You just have to respond to it. And on the commercial side, there's some of that is done too. You go to suppliers and, okay, here's a spec, build something to this specification for me. And there's no dialogue in terms of defining, you know, what is the environment is that going to operate in, and what are the reliability requirements, and not only just requirements, but what happens if it does fail in the field? What's mm-hmm. the impact to operation of the product if there's a failure in this particular subsystem or whatever the focus is on in terms of the acquisition? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it requires that dialogue, and I've done some work in lean product development, and one of the things that's really good about it is the way requirements are done up front. It involves doing a interface with the customer, voice of customer session, where you actually go out and meet with the customer, see the application he's working in. Mm-hmm. And you go through, you work with all types, marketing, engineering, you know, project managers and so on. And they come up with a group of needs, and those are prioritized using a technique where it's kind of compared alternatives. You take two of them, and which is more important than the other, and there's an exercise, a analytical hierarchy matrix that you prepare to rank requirements and mm-hmm. And help with trade-off decisions, and which ones are absolute needs, which are just targets or nice to have, and which are essential. And that kind of ranks the various requirements in terms of importance, and that helps the team focus on developing according to those prioritized requirements. But it establishes that dialogue with the customer in terms of what's needed, what happens if it does fail or fail to meet that particular requirement, and what's the impact. And so you can kind of look at that and weigh the requirements. But without that dialogue, just the danger I see all too often is just blindly going with a spec document. Okay, we're going to do that. And then you actually get out there and find, well, that wasn't documented in the spec. There's some environmental condition that was not considered because it was never put into that document. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Those requirements documents are only as good as whoever puts them together, and they may overlook some critical item that could adversely impact reliability or performance.
Well, it goes both ways, though. And I think the dialogue, whether it's a focus group or a set of not quite joint development, I think it's joint understanding is probably a better phrase for it, but it's where do you expect your customers to use this? And then how do you, what's the day in the life of your product? And that's where I think we, as reliability professionals come in, we start bridging that. It's a dusty environment. We need to, you know, that's bad from a reliability point of view. What are we going to do about that? Oh, this is going to be in direct sunlight. That's bad for reliability. Let's figure out how much and how often it's going to do that. And we start recognizing the stresses from the use environment that may or may not have been documented, and which may trigger the connections to the type of technology that we're using. Because dust may not matter at all if we're creating a sealed container that's not going to have any dust ingress. It's just not going to be an issue. But if we got great big fans trying to cool the system, well, now we got a problem, right? So when you do these kinds of discussions, I've seen them done where it's a focus group kind of thing, and it's more on industrial design, or it's more on functionality. It's, you know, how do people use it? And then it's kind of a subset. Well, what happens if it fails? But the way you described it, John, it sounds like it's more focused on the reliability, durability type discussion.
Not entirely true. I think it allows more discussion on the reliability side than you would have otherwise, but it's all the requirements for the product. So you're looking at not only the reliability needs, but also the performance parameters that it has to meet. And so that helps with the trade-off decisions in terms of, you know, yeah, these are going to be conflicting requirements. How do we address both of those? And what's a workable compromise that lets us, you know, do a good trade-off and meet the needs of both? The other part of it is it's getting out early in the design process to a customer's facility where the product's going to be used, so you can actually see the operating environment. And those have been tremendously helpful.
You mean get the designers out of their cubes, their offices?
Absolutely. Yeah. Get out there and see how the thing is being used. And particularly from a, you know, as a supplier of sub-assemblies or that type of approach where you're going into a system that's going to be operated in another environment, and you get to see how your product is going to be used and integrated into their system, and it's tremendously helpful.
Everybody's house is not like yours. Everybody's factory is not like yours. Environment's not like yours. I've seen that happen way too many times where they design it for as if it was going to be on their lab bench forever. Yeah. And
not the way it is.
No. Not the way it is. Now, when I was at Hewlett-Packard, one of the things that I want to say it was the quality group. It might have been actually marketing, but it was a joint document. And there they had a pretty good sense of what a home printer would go into or an office printer would go into worldwide. And they had huge programs to document what these things actually did. And there were customer visits ongoing, and they would take photos. And this is how a printer is installed in a home in Japan or in Denmark or in India or in the US. And they were doing snapshots and lots of measurements, but it gave us ideas of the variability of airflow. Just some places it was stuffed into a bookcase and completely covered with things.
Yeah, you go to some of the other places in the world, the space is much less and much more crowded. So you start packing it in between other things or piling things on top of it. And it's not what you would expect. But
right. That's the way customers, it was a farmer in Ohio or in Iowa. To use a stereotype, this guy had his computer and printer system in his barn. And, you know, it was up against the barn boards and you could see through the slats and you could see the cows were there and all this stuff. And like, okay, that's not where we expected a home printer to be used, but it's there.
Yeah. So, those kind of things where you, and sometimes your marketing people do a pretty good job at it. You know, they'll get out there and do the preliminary interface with the customer before there's a proposal to come up with a solution for what the customer is asking for. And so they've gathered some of that information. That's a good starting point. Mm-hmm. But then that can raise questions to, you know, do you need to investigate this further to really understand that environment?
Or, for example, if you're going to attach something to a combine, for example, harvesting combine, most designers would say, there's a lot of big mechanical structures on that and an uneven surface. It's going to vibrate. And, I don't know if there's a standard for that. You know, John Deere doesn't publish their internal measurements on the vibration that the cabin sees or the external sees.
They actually do that. They have GPS systems that go in farm equipment and guide them down the rows in these humongous fields and so on. Mm-hmm. And there's a bunch of electronics on there. It is in an adverse environment.
Well, there's air conditioner systems in these things. There's ham radios in the old days. There's, entertainment systems. There's all kinds of stuff in them. And as you're creating a new product into that, some of this stuff's documented out there. But some of it, you're just going to have to break out those accelerometers and go make measurements. And it takes time to fully understand. It's not enough to know that, it's got vibration.
Yeah.
No, well, you gotta know how much?
How bad? yeah. And that's the, I think the real message is don't assume anything. You know, assumptions will get you into trouble. So if you assume an environment, you might be surprised, and that can lead to issues down the field later. And then you got a big scramble to fix it. So you don't want to make those assumptions. You want to know as much as you can about the operating environment.
There really are two parts to it, though, isn't there, John? Is one of them is, well, the initial concept is, well, what problem are we trying to solve? Or the initial discussion, you know, is well, here's what we want to try to do. And as that gets fleshed out, it's, well, we know we got to deal with the various environmental stresses. Well, two parts to that. One is, do you have the right list? Is dust or fungus or insects, are those serious threats to your product the way it's being used or not? And do you need to consider them or not? And then what's the variability of that stress? So some printers, for example, were set up beautifully ready for showcase photography, you know, and others were not.
Yeah.
So it's, what's the range of variability of these different stresses? And one of the things to keep in mind is that you can design a product that will work, say, at the higher temperatures of what you expect the operating range to be or what you measure it to be. And that's great. Yet that may not be what causes the failure mechanisms to occur. It may be thermal cycling. It may be fire ants eating the insulation off of your product.
I think what you're kind of getting at is looking at all, here's all the potential based on what we know about this environment. Here's potential stresses that we could have. Which ones are really going to be a threat to our product or concept design?
Oh, what's that mil-spec that lists all kinds of different stresses?
It's an 800 series where it's all the
810?
Environmental. Yeah, I think it's 810, the newest one. It was just released a year or two ago, so it's pretty good. It's got a real good vibration section that was updated in it and had inputs by Wayne Tustin and others. It's much improved over the earlier versions.
Oh, that's
but
great.
Yeah, it's 810, yeah.
Now, that's a environmental testing.
Yeah.
Now, I have always used that document, though, as a check step early in a program to say, well, here's all of the types of stresses, right, that you can deal with. It doesn't cover everything. If you're going to install something in the space station, for example, you got to consider that there's no gravity. And I don't think 810 has a gravity-free stress condition, for example, but it does have ballistic shock. It does have insects and fungus and molds and salt spray, and it becomes a good checklist.
It's been accumulated over years with a number of different products, and it does tend to lean towards the, you know, military equipment, whether it's land, sea, or air. But that still covers a lot of the potential environments that are out there. So, yeah, it is a good checklist to consider which are the stresses that would most likely do more damage to your product. And yeah, and here's some ways you can test for it. And then you have to kind of tailor it to your particular needs. But yeah, it's a good reference to, here's stresses we need to consider from a environmental standpoint that could degrade the reliability of the product.
Might be part of that voice of the customer discussions is, you know, well, do you have, is it protected from dust? Is it in a controlled environment room? Or here's this checklist of different stresses. Do these apply or don't apply the way you expect to use this product? Mm-hmm. For example, I don't know if A10 has it, but it's the lubricants and petrochemicals from like under the hood of a vehicle. That can be really bad for a lot of different products, or good, depending on what's there.
Yeah. And we're putting, you know, a lot of electronics under the hood of the vehicle now. So you have a very severe temperature environment, and then you've got moisture, and you got the oil-based products. And so it can be pretty adverse and needs to be protected against.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, A10 is a good starting point if you're looking at doing that. I think what you're saying, though, John, and I agree, is, well, talk to your customer.
Yeah.
Convince those sales guys and marketing guys that it's okay despite what the Dilbert cartoon shows, that engineers can talk to customers. It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and you really need to. Yeah, that's in the cases where I've done it, I found it immensely valuable to go out. And so I did one that was on semiconductor wafer processing and go out to some of the vendors that make equipment that handle the wafers during processing. And all the stresses that are in that environment are pretty interesting. Everything from plasmas to extreme temperatures to, and so understanding what is going on in their process is really valuable to go out and actually see that. In this case, we had to get dressed up in the protective suits and go out in the labs and see how it's used. But it was immensely revealing in terms of the operating environment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think there's much substitute for that. And it does take time. And and I don't think it ever stops. I think it's as you develop an understanding of what stresses matter to your product, as you change technologies, as you move to different material sets and stuff, you got to reassess that. And are we considering the right stresses again? And
yeah,
then
absolutely.
Catalog the range of variability that you're seeing. It's not enough to say min-max temperature. It's, well, what's the distribution of temperatures and how often does it cycle? Those become even more important.
And some products may be in a fairly consistent environment, like the wafer processing stuff. The industry has got some pretty stringent requirements for that, but other products were like your printers, it can be anywhere and everywhere, and so you got to consider a much broader perspective.
But that's very true. Very true.
I've had I think like 3 HP printers now, and I've gotten a lot of years out of them. They've been pretty good. I've had the last 2 have been the kind of the all-in-one photo smart thing where it does scanning, printing, copying, and
Have you ever hooked up the fax machine on it, the fax capability?
No, that's kind of a dying technology, let's call it.
That's right. Yeah, that feature set's probably going to get discontinued here sooner or later.
Yeah, I haven't really used it for that, but the other things work pretty well.
And it's funny is when those all-in-ones were first coming out, the fax capability was a big discussion about getting the environment right for it because now we're adding the telecommunications, the phone line. And it has its own quirks and feature sets and variability. And so we did a bunch of work to understand the variability of phone signals.
Earlier in my career, I did work for Konica. And they made copiers and fax machines. And so I have had some exposure to doing dedicated fax machines. And it has its quirks and problems. And
Well, anyway, it's obsolete now, especially the first time we sent an email with an attachment. And we're like, oh, that was a lot quicker. And we can actually read it.
I think even the where you do have to handwrite stuff and the various e-fax kinds of things where you can do it on your phone now or whatever and sign it, send a fax. You don't really need the old connectivity issues that you used to have. But
well, you realize though, John, that half of our audience going, fax, what's that? You
know,
is that like those old spinning discs that you used to listen to music on?
Those are coming back.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. We'll have to talk about the resurgence of some old technologies.
I've got some good examples there. I still have some audio equipment from back in the 70s. I have 2 turntables. I have quite a collection of vinyl. And I have one newer turntable that has the USB conversion, so you can convert it to put on your iPod and so on.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that is available. But, it's making a real resurgence. A lot of the manufacturers are reintroducing turntables. And now some of the amplifiers and receivers don't have the phono preamp in it anymore.
That's right.
And that it's a much lower level signal coming out of it. So it takes a preamp. And so then you have to get a separate preamp or find one that does have that feature. But some of the Japanese stuff from the 70s, I still have some of it. It never has failed. It's tremendously reliable. Those are, some of them are even pre-printed circuit boards. They're pre-integrated circuits, I should say. They have discrete.
All discrete through-hole components.
Yeah.
Those will last forever.
Yeah, just don't fail.
That's right. But you love it when those happen. Unfortunately, those tended to be very expensive to put together and assemble and ship and all those things. So.
It's interesting to look at those, how they designed and built them and made it as reliable as it has been. So.
That's right. Well, we'll have to come back to that. But one of the things I want to ask our audience about is you know, we mentioned the 810 standard is a pretty decent list of stresses. And yet, what have you found? What has been the most surprising stress that you've encountered that is something you need to make sure your team is aware of and understands and characterizes? Because it's, I think, the idea of just sharing the types of stresses that can cause problems. And remember, it's not always just in the customer's end use environment. It could be in transportation. It could be an installation process. It could be in your manufacturing process. All of those various stages add stress to your product that can lead to failures. And so leave us a note. Go to reliability.fm, find the various shows there, and there's plenty of places to leave comments and input and feedback. So John, hopefully we sparked a few thoughts or ideas and maybe a couple of takeaways. And we'll just wrap this one up right here.
Okay. Thank you, Fred. Right. Good discussion.
Yeah. Thanks, John. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.